What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Shireen Abu-Akleh, among Arab media's most prominent figures and widely hailed for her bravery and professionalism, who covered the Palestinian cause and Israel's brutality, is no more. Israel has killed her. Yet this is not the first time that a journalist, a Palestinian one, has been killed by Israeli forces. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Israel believes killing journalists can prevent the truth from coming out when it comes to their crimes in the occupied territories.
Palestinian reporter Shireen Abu-Akleh was shot while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. The veteran reporter who worked for Al Jazeera's Arab language channel was shot in the face by Israeli forces despite wearing a blue flak jacket clearly marked with press. Israeli officials claim Palestinians may be responsible for the death of the 51-year-old journalist. But another reporter accompanying Abu-Akleh, who was also shot in the back, rejected the Israeli claim as a lie.
The occupation is murderous and criminal. They shot us for no reason. We were shocked by the shooting. I was lucky and I turned my back when the first bullet was shot and injured my back. They wanted to kill me. I was injured in my back and the second bullet shot my colleague Shireen and caused her death. There were no armed people and we cannot put our lives in danger and say the wrong narrative. The Israeli army is a liar and criminal and despicable.
Al Jazeera also said Abu-Akleh was assassinated in cold blood and urged the international community to hold Israeli forces responsible. The Palestinian Authority said Abu-Akleh's killing is a heinous crime and part of the occupation's policy of targeting journalists to obscure the truth and commit crimes silently. In Gaza, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas described the killing as a new crime against journalism in Palestine, while the Islamic Jihad movement branded it an unsuccessful attempt to cover up realities. The journalist's murder also drew widespread condemnation from countries across the world, such as Iran, Pakistan, and Belgium. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh called Abu-Akleh's killing a deliberate and criminal act. The United Nations called for an immediate and thorough investigation and for those responsible to be held accountable, a request that was echoed by the European Union.
We immediately called for a swift and independent investigation so that the perpetrators of this terrible crime can be brought to justice.
The International Federation of Journalists said it would submit Abu-Akleh's case to the International Criminal Court. Abu-Akleh's murder is just the tip of the iceberg of crimes committed by Israel against journalists. Reporters Without Borders say nearly 150 Palestinian journalists have been wounded by Israeli forces across the Gaza Strip and the West Bank since 2018. Israeli strikes also destroyed a building housing local offices of media outlets during its last year's war on Gaza. Such atrocity, along with frequent raids and shootings in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, show that the Israeli regime has no scruples about murdering unarmed Palestinians. The silence of the international community is also seen as a green light for Israel to continue such crimes.
Well, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Joining us is Mustafa Barghouti, Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council, who joins us from occupied Ramallah. Also joining us, Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who joins us from San Francisco.
This is The Spotlight, The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mustafa Barghoutini, let me first start with you. Obviously, this is a very sad day for what has occurred. I'm sure you'll agree, and it's still being felt all across, at a minimum, the occupied territories, and if not, around the world, for people who knew who Abu Akleh was, who was shot the way she was and went out of this life the way she did. Tell us your initial thoughts, especially after you heard what happened, and how you feel now.
Well, we'll feel very sad. I mean, it's not just the group of people who knew Shireen like myself directly for the last 26 years, but the feeling of sadness is across the whole Palestinian population. Shireen Abu Akleh entered every house in Palestine during the last 25 years with her brave and extremely professional reporting of the situation in Palestine. I would say even she probably has entered every Arab house in the region and maybe other countries. And today the feeling of sadness and the loss is among all Palestinians. But the other side of the matter is that she was killed in cold blood by an Israeli assassin, by an Israeli sniper. And the whole responsibility of her death lies on the shoulders of the Israeli army, the Israeli government, the Prime Minister of Israel, the Minister of Army in Israel, and all the people who are oppressing the Palestinian people along the situation of occupation and apartheid. Let me tell you that since 2000, 55 journalists, including now Shireen Abu Akleh, have been killed by the Israeli army. It's not a unique incident. It's not an isolated incident. It's a systematic oppression of Palestinian journalists. And as you said, since 2018, 150 of these journalists were injured by the Israeli army. What we demand and what we insist on is accountability. And we insist that the world community stop the system of double standard and eliminate the situation where Israel is not held accountable for its crimes. It's time for Israeli officials to be held accountable. It's time to end the impunity that Israel enjoys all the time. And I would really like specifically to comment on what the UN American representative said. She continued to repeat the Israeli line of talking about an investigation committee which would include the Israelis. This is totally unacceptable. It's like allowing the accused to investigate himself and allowing the person who committed the crime to be the one who decides whether he committed a crime or not. And it's totally unacceptable for us. What we demand is an international independent commission. And we know that Israel has never allowed any international independent commission from coming here and investigating its crimes. What my message to the American side is, just imagine if Shireen Abu Akleh was killed today in Ukraine. Will we hear this hesitant talk about what has happened? Or it will be condemnation after condemnation and consideration that this is a serious crime. Well, this double standard must end, and it's time for justice in Palestine, not only for Shireen Abu Akleh, but for the 100,000, not only for Shireen Abu Akleh, but for all the 100,000 Palestinians who have been killed by Israeli forces since 1948.
Okay, well, raised a very good point there. So I'm going to ask you, Richard Becker, what our guest Mustafa Barghouti said, if this was an American reporter who was killed in Ukraine, let's say. What kind of coverage is there, since you're in San Francisco, Richard Becker, on this? in the U.S. media, and of course what our guest mentioned there as a valid point.
Well, it's undoubtedly a valid point, and my greetings to your other guest, Mustafa Barghouti, and our condolences, first of all, to the family and many, many friends and admirers of Shireen Abu Akleh. This is a terrible crime, and there's some attention in the media here to it, but nothing like what there would be if, as Mustafa suggests, you know, a very prominent U.S. reporter killed anywhere, particularly in a conflict that the U.S. was on one side and the those who carried out the crime were on the other side, there would be hysteria in the media, quite frankly. And there's no question. There apparently were two shots fired, according to her colleague, who was seriously wounded with a shot in the back. One shot hit him, and then the next shot hit her. These aren't random shots. These are sniper assassinations, or attempted assassination in the case of a colleague. And the fact that at the UN, we have the U.S. ambassador continuing to really echo and to regurgitate what's coming out of the occupation, out of the Israeli occupiers, it shows the complete bankruptcy of the pretensions that the U.S. has to be any kind of a broker in this struggle, or calling it that it's seeking real justice. It's not. The Israelis will cover this up, I believe, as they've covered up so much else. And the U.S. will support them in covering it up, I believe, as they have so many times before. I want to mention that one reference point, when the Great March of Return happened in Gaza, in which the Palestinians were demonstrating to bring the Palestinian issue back to center of world attention, really, and the demonstrations, I think in all those demonstrations, there were two or three Israelis, and this was over months, one was killed and a couple others who suffered some kind of injury, but on the Palestinian side, there were at least 271 killed, and 30,000 who were injured and wounded by the Israeli forces. And the Palestinians were in a position where they could do very little, except, I think, very heroically demonstrate that there must be an end to the occupation. And the Israeli general who had been in charge, the Israeli commander who had been in charge, later said, of all those wounds, all the bullets that killed, the bullets that led to amputations and other lifelong injuries to people, he said, we knew where every bullet went. Something to keep in mind today.
Let's open that up, Mustafa Barghouti, because still, when you sift through the online media posts, there are still many who say that it was Israel is in the right and that there should be an investigation. And some are blaming some. Israel has come out saying that this is Palestinian gunfire that may have been the cause. But let's break this open a little bit and use your expertise in the matter. Because when you take a look at the facts, I mean, this is a very well-known reporter. I'm sure she has been on the Israeli radar for quite some time because she's covered the occupied territories. And in particular, where she was, Jenin. Jenin is an area where Palestinians have been known to be very outspoken when it comes to the Israeli regime in terms of how they've protested and voiced their anger. It almost makes it look like the whoever from the Israeli side shot her would be aware of who she is, especially when there was nothing going on around her at the time. And, of course, based on the fact that she has reported so much. Do you think that this was something... I don't want to say premeditated, but was on the minds of whoever shot the trigger, knowing who she was?
I don't know if the one who, the Israeli who assassinated her, knew exactly who she was, or he was just shooting all the journalists in the area to terrorize them and prevent them from bringing the truth about the reality, especially that we know that it seems that the Israeli army was planning a vicious attack again on Jenin camp. But also there are some other facts. I mean, Shireen was one of the main reporters who reported the massacre in Jenin camp 20 years ago, when the Israeli army reinvaded every city and every part of the West Bank. And she was well known for reporting in a very objective and professional manner all the other crimes that were committed against Palestinians. So yes, she was a target for sure, but all the journalists were a target. And what happened today is already well documented. There wasn't even, there wasn't only one or two shootings. Actually, there were several shots. And if you watch the tapes, you can hear them. And the first shot injured Ali Samoudi, who is the partner correspondent with Shireen. And she screamed that he was shot because she saw it. And then immediately she fell down after being shot in the head. So, and then when her other, when a third reporter was there, was tried to move to, they shot at her. And when a fourth person came to help Shireen, who fell down to help evacuate her, he was also shot at. So you are talking about systematic shooting that took place probably by more than one Israeli soldier. These were probably snipers that were stationed there, as the Israeli army does before invading the Jenin camp. They spread snipers in different areas so that they would shoot Palestinians who try to maybe stand up to them or try to escape or whatever. What is other, the other very important fact is that there were no Palestinian gunmen there, no Palestinian demonstrators, no Palestinian civilians even at all. The only people present in the region were seven journalists, including Shireen Abu Akleh, and the Israeli army with its armored vehicles and soldiers. So it's a very clear picture. I don't think we need even an investigation to find out what has happened, especially that the bullet that was found fragmented and has exploded inside the head of Shireen Abu Akleh, destroying much of her brain. So basically here, this is a very clear crime. This is a very clear act.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that. For a second, we lost you, Mustafa Barghouti. Well, we should have known this was going to come, Richard Becker. We should have somehow interpreted what Naftali Bennett said weeks ago, that something of this magnitude would happen. Because when you had that attack, I don't know if you recall, Richard Becker, that happened in Tel Aviv, the resistance act of which you had a Palestinian that took out some lives. Naftali Bennett came out, and I'm going to quote him, and I was surprised after reading what he said after that. Vowing no limit after there were three killed by the Palestinian freedom fighter, or security forces will have full freedom to act, free rein to deal with threats. There are not and will not be limits for this war. We are granting full freedom of action to the army, the Shin Bet, domestic intelligence agency, and all security forces in order to defeat what he calls the terror. And he went on to say, every murderer knows we will find them. Everyone who helps the terrorists should know that they will pay a heavy price. What do you think? I mean, this is something that obviously shows that something like this would have eventually happened. And today is obviously one sign of it.
Well, it's the green light, and the green light has been given over and over and over again. I wanted to mention, I was at the Jenin camp 20 years ago, which Mr. Barghouti mentioned, after the destruction of the camp, the bulldozing of it, and the massacre that took place there. And it's an unbelievable scene to see the whole center of the camp destroyed. And so what we're talking about is the policy. It's not a new policy. There's a new green light, you know, kind of a reminder green light that comes from Bennett. But this has been the policy for decades. This has been the policy, in fact, which the foundation of the State of Israel was built upon. The ethnic cleansing that took place in 1947 and 1948 and 1949 and again in 1967 and at other times as well, that cannot be carried out. The ethnic cleansing cannot be carried out without terror, without violence. And it's never called that in the media here in the U.S. Terror is only used in reference to the Palestinians or those who are resisting, but it was really the creation of the Israeli state and the conquest of the West Bank and the continued occupation has been based on a policy of granting to the military and to the settlers, of course, in the West Bank, the right, the so-called right to carry out unlimited violence, as Bennett put it, unlimited violence against the Palestinian population.
Okay, Mustafa Barghouti, in your capacity, you have been obviously very active throughout the years, and you've highlighted all the actions, the illegalities of the occupation of what many reports have indicated to be an apartheid regime. When you have an incident like this happen, and as you said, you personally knew Shireen, and I'm sure many people who grew up with her, whom either through online statements or even interviews done, have said that we grew up with this lady. How can there be a mobilization of any kind in order to prevent this from happening, in order to have accountability? What avenues need to be taken and what action needs to be taken, in your opinion?
First of all, let me also mention that Shireen Abu Akleh is also an American citizen, in addition to being a Palestinian citizen, which means that the challenge here is also for the American administration and the American establishment. You're talking here about a person who's carrying American citizenship. I mean, I would expect much different kind of behavior if there was equality and if there was if there wasn't this terrible level double standard that is practiced. Now, what needs to be done, in my opinion, we need to mobilize to expose completely the Israeli oppression system. Not just in the case of Shireen Abu Akleh. Shireen Abu Akleh should open the door to investigate all the 55 cases of Palestinian journalists killed since 2000 and maybe before that. It should also open the door to investigate the crimes that were committed against medical personnel. One of my colleagues, who was a young woman, Razan Najjar, 21 years old, a few years ago was shot in the heart while she was providing first aid to injured people in Gaza. I was myself in 96, by the way, exposed to an act of shooting by a sniper in Ramallah, and I got 35 shrapnels that remain in my back. So I know exactly how this experience happens. We need to open up the whole system of oppression to expose it to the world and demand punitive acts. What we should demand is sanctions against Israeli establishment, sanctions against the system of apartheid. Shireen Abu Akleh fought very bravely to bring the truth to the world, but I think she will continue to fight even after her death. Her spirit will continue to fight for justice. And I think her provides us with an amazing opportunity to really expose the whole Israeli system and demand what Israel deserves, which is a real strong BDS movement, maybe still used against the apartheid system in South Africa.
Okay, unfortunately we're out of time, but thank you so much for that, Mustafa Barghouti, Palestine Liberation Organization Central Council from Ramallah. Thank you. Richard Baker, thank you for your input from the Answer Coalition from San Francisco. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Ikaba Tahwai. It's goodbye until next time.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن العقلاء تركوا فضول الدنيا فكيف الذنوب وترك الدنيا من الفضل وترك الذنوب من الفرض.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "The people of intellect have abandoned the excesses of this world. But what about sins? Forsaking worldly excesses is merely a virtue, whereas abandoning sins is an obligation."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has these beautiful conversations, these beautiful dialogues with his friends, his companions, his family members and his relatives, and the people in general. This divinely appointed Imam has this one beautiful conversation where he talks to his companion about tribulations and the role that supplication and dua plays when it comes to tribulations. In response to the companion's query, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, "When a tribulation befalls a believing servant, and Allah the Great and Almighty inspires them with supplication, the tribulation is going to be removed. And when a tribulation befalls a believing servant, and they refrain from supplicating to Allah, the tribulation ends up lasting for a long time." And then Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says to his companion, "Therefore, when tribulation comes down, adhere to supplication and implore Allah, the Great and Mighty." So, dear friends, supplication is truly something which is very important. And not only is it important, but it can change the course of our lives. For as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, "When tribulation befalls a mu'min and Allah inspires them to supplicate, that tribulation is then removed. But on the contrary, when we decide to not supplicate to Allah, when we become arrogant or when we despair, then we don't do dua, and the tribulation ends up lasting for a long time." So in the trials and tribulations and calamities and hardships and difficulties of our life, dear brothers and sisters, always remember to hold on fast to supplication and ad-du'a to Almighty Allah. This is Dialogue, Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Atar, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Now, I just wanted to point out to the intellectual aspect of the Imam. There's a very beautiful hadith, a very long hadith from Hisham ibn Hakam, one of the greatest theologians. There's a lot of things to mention in regards to him as well, and how he debated, how he challenged great scholars by going to Baghdad, by going to different Basra, by going to different places, and he challenged them. And he promoted the phenomena, the ideology, or the thought of imamat and wilayat, you know, by defeating them, right? Like that famous, in that big masjid of Baghdad, that he goes, a great scholar sitting on the pulpit, and he's explaining, and then he says, I have few simple questions to ask. You know, what do you do with your ear? What do you do with your eyes? What do you do with your mouth? You know, the scholar was saying, what are you, you know, why are you asking these questions? He said, why don't you answer it? And eventually pointing out to where does this all commands come from? All of these commands comes from the aql. So aql is that, you know, reality of imamat. You know, how can this whole creation be left without that sort of intellectual reality where the whole creation is guided towards, whether this little creation of our is guided by our aql the same way? Then that's how he introduced imamat in big gatherings. Now there's a very beautiful hadith from the seventh imam in regards to Hisham ibn Hakam, and that is in regards to aql. They say, imam says that, you know, there is two hujjat. One hujjat is internal hujjat, internal proof, and there is another hujjat, which is outside. The internal proof, the esoteric reality or the internal reality or the proof is the intellect of man. Aql of man is considered as hujjat from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And there is external hujjat, which are considered to be the imams, which are considered to be the anbiya, which are considered to be the prophets and the messengers of God. Now, there has to be a correlation. There has to be a relationship. If the internal aql goes or makes an error, then you have the external aql, which will really rectify it and correct it. That's why we say that Islam is a religion of fitra. Islam is a religion of aql.
For listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds Battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups Mili Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime, forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, port, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Representatives from 55 countries and 22 international organizations gathered in Brussels on Tuesday to raise money for Syrians impacted by more than a decade of conflict.
The total pledge amounts to 6.4 billion euros.
Aid agencies say that amount pales into insignificance when compared to the colossal amount of money the West continues to pump into the Ukrainian army, not to mention the cost of taking in a huge number of Ukrainian refugees. Rights groups point out that 7 million Syrian refugees fled to neighbouring countries while the EU closed its borders to them during the past 11 years. Recently, within weeks, the EU welcomed 5 million Ukrainian refugees. For the first time, Russia was not invited to the annual fundraising conference for Syria in Brussels. Moscow was even singled out for blame.
The Russian war will increase food and energy prices, and the situation in Syria will become worse.
Critics say it was in fact the US and its EU allies that tore Syria apart and then turned their backs on the Syrian people. The West tried in vain for years to oust Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Russia should have been invited to the Brussels conference, it suggested. Analysts say Vladimir Putin's address delivered last Monday was moderate in tone.
So maybe this is the momentum which needs to be seized by the Americans, by the European Union, and say, okay, we have to figure this out. Let's see that we can talk.
Delegates heard how 90% of people in Syria are living in poverty. Groups like Oxfam and Save the Children say all the financial pledges made must be kept. That has not happened in previous years. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Opposition leader Keir Starmer has been at the front of the chorus urging Prime Minister Boris Johnson to do the decent thing and step down after being fined for his part in a series of lockdown gatherings dubbed Partygate. Now the Labour leader has become embroiled in a controversy of his own, nicknamed Currygate, after being pictured enjoying a meal and a drink in what the party's calling a work event, but one being dubbed an illegal gathering by his opponents.
First and foremost, no rules were broken. I don't actually believe that those that are accusing me believe rules were broken. They are trying to simply drag all politicians into a place where the public think we're all the same. For me, this is an in-principle position. No rules were broken. I'm absolutely clear about that. But in the event that I'm wrong about that and I get a fixed penalty notice, I will do the right thing and step down.
Political observers think this is a risky strategy.
Well, I think that his advisers think this is a really good ploy to contrast him with Boris Johnson, who, of course, didn't resign, having been fined for breaking the lockdown regulations. But it's a dangerous ploy as well, because he's not in control of what the police investigation is going to find. And if he does get fined, he's now been committed to resigning as leadership of the Labour Party.
The Labour Party had desperately wanted to take the moral high ground when it came to their handling of COVID rules and regulations, not just in the House of Commons, but in the court of public opinion. But now with their leader caught in the spotlight because of his own missteps, supporters of Boris Johnson are hoping to capitalise on this political mistake and make Labour pay. Whether or not the leader of the Labour Party is fined, for many of the electorate, this is yet another letdown. Politicians who seemingly are unwilling or unable to play by the rules. The police investigation could take as long as a month to conclude. Now Labour and its leader must play the waiting game and cross their political fingers that this high-stake gamble has paid off. Mina Taylor, London.
When you visit Afghan markets, especially those in Kabul, you find numerous Iranian goods. In some places, Iranian products even make a bigger part of bazaars, as their prices match the economy of Afghans.
Most of the goods we buy from superstores are products of Iran. They're of high quality and the companies have got a good reputation. Most importantly, Iranian goods are cheaper than those of other countries. I usually buy Iranian washing liquid, food items, and halal drinks. My family is happy with these products.
A number of salespersons and customers have also described some Iranian products as items with good quality. Cultural proximity is another reason for Afghans to dislike Iranian products.
First of all, Iran is our neighboring country. Its products arrive in Afghan markets sooner and cheaper. Second, their quality is also acceptable. For instance, this Danish cheese has an expiry date of 1 year, but that of Iranian cheese is 3 to 6 months. People usually like fresh food with short expiry dates.
I always do my shopping here at this nearby supermarket. Luckily, it has Iranian goods, which better match our demands and cultural values. We also share a common taste with Iranians. Let's not forget that Iran products are economically suitable for our situation. With less money, we can buy more items.
Iran and Afghanistan, besides sharing borders, have had many cultural and ideological values in common. The two countries are missing no chance to enhance bilateral trade ties either. There is no market in Afghanistan without Iranian goods. Nowadays, more and more Afghan families are turning to Iranian products, partly due to reasonable prices. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Conservative Yoon Suk-yeol was inaugurated president of South Korea in a ceremony in front of the country's National Assembly. Although President Yoon has vowed to take a hard line on North Korea, his address offered Pyongyang conditional assistance.
If North Korea genuinely embarks on a process to complete denuclearization, we are prepared to work with the international community to present an audacious plan that will vastly strengthen North Korea's economy and improve the quality of life for its people.
The South's President Yoon's words may ring hollow for North Korea, as President Yoon has promised to bolster the country's military deterrent and strengthen its alliance with the United States. Some analysts suggest that may be destabilizing.
The U.S.-South Korea alliance will improve considerably in the next 5 years of the Yoon Suk-yeol administration, but North Korea's nuclear capabilities will be enhanced and tensions on the Korean peninsula will heighten even more.
South Koreans want President Yoon to address a raft of domestic issues as well, including housing and economic disparity.
Stabilizing housing prices is a priority for me, and I would like to have economic policies that can make a better living for both corporations and individuals and cover blind spots in the current policies.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol wasted no time in demonstrating the hardline deterrent strategy his administration intends to take with North Korea. The U.S. and South Korean militaries began combined exercises with F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft just hours before Yoon took office. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Victory Day is celebrated on May 9th in Russia as one of the most important holidays in the country, as it marks the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union. An estimated 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians were killed in the Second World War, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War, or the holiday with tears in the eyes. This year's celebrations come at a time when Russia's relations with the West are at their lowest level. NATO countries openly supply Ukraine with weapons and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbas.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure.
We saw how the military infrastructure is being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work, regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries were going on. The danger grew every day. Russia gave a preemptive rebuff to aggression. It was a forced, timely, and only correct decision, the decision of a sovereign, strong, and independent country.
And after the traditional military parade in Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the Army and Navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe.
In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness.
Marina Kartunova, Moscow. The Palestinian conflict is the longest-running conflict on record for the United Nations. Multiple attempts at reaching a lasting peace have been and gone. Now, conveners of the Convivencia Initiative have spent years poring over a new document that they hope will become the blueprint for a movement that will push for a just peace for Palestinians.
People forget that for almost 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and later Muslims lived in total harmony in Palestine. The Jews in Palestine were Palestinians. There was no division, there was no racism, there was no anti-Semitism. All these are European inventions.
The vision of stepping away from violence in Palestine and the region can only work if movements for peace are supported by genuine reconciliation and justice at their heart. Now, this bold new initiative being launched in London is putting true solidarity between Muslims, Christians, and Jews at its foundation and hoping for global success.
The suspicions around interfaith dialogue have also been an obstacle.
It was perhaps the first time I've seen something with a vision for Palestine, bringing together Jews, Muslims and Christians here in the UK and abroad, working together for justice and peace in Palestine. Because too often, interfaith dialogue is what I call lowest common denominator. I've been involved in activities with Jewish groups where they say, well, we can't talk about Palestine, or we can't talk about the settlements. And therefore, it shuts down genuine conversation about the causes of the justice in Palestine.
Obviously, without justice and equality and freedom for the Palestinians as well as the Jewish-Israeli inhabitants of that area, there can never be a proper peace. If there's not peace in the Middle East, we know that, unfortunately, there are ramifications for the rest of us in all our societies.
With a growing list of supporters, the hope is to spread the spirit of convivencia.
Even a little child understands justice. If we don't stand against injustice and support each other, what's the point of coming together? And this is really a challenge to create a better future for ourselves, for our children, not just in Palestine, but everywhere else.
For far too long, division has defined the ongoing crisis. But this new initiative is forging the path to a united and just solution for Palestine and the world. Amina Taylor, London.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, then regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary. Point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subhi Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in north-occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance. A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar.
From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulema's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.